This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection, and I'll introduce my guest shortly. I thought I'd share a little bit of information that came across my desk earlier this month. Columbia University has a National Center for Addiction and Substance Abuse, and they've been kind of watching how controlled drugs are being dispensed through online pharmacies, and they've finished reporting their fifth look at this, and they note that about 85% of 365 websites that advertised or sold drugs that included OxyContin, Valium, Xanax, Vicodin, Ritalin, and Adderall, all controlled substances, did not require a prescription. In fact, 42% explicitly stated that no prescription was needed. 45% offered cursory online consultations, and 13% made no mention of a prescription whatsoever. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency had estimated in 2007 that 11% of all prescriptions filled at a traditional pharmacy were for controlled substances. This compares to 80% of the prescriptions filled by internet pharmacies. And Columbia University points out as well, there's no controls that block access to these sites by children and teens. My guest today is Daniel Friedland. Daniel's been on the program once before, and I've met him a couple of times. He's a very big man and a leader in evidence-based medicine. He's author of the one of the basic texts on this subject, Evidence-Based Medicine, the Framework for Clinical Practice. However, besides trying to teach physicians and professionals how to think more critically about healthcare, he's also helping patients do the same thing through his website, Super Smart Health. It's with a great pleasure I introduce Dr. Friedland back to Line One. Welcome again, Dr. Friedland.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. A real pleasure to be here with you.
Let's go over for a second before we get into what we can do about finding information about medical questions, about what evidence-based medicine is all about.
Yeah, there's some wordy definitions on this. The simplest way to think about it is that evidence-based medicine is the application of the best available evidence to the care of patients. And then to really think about what that best available evidence is, it places a premium on rigorous research as a starting point, optimally in the form of well-done randomized controlled trials and well-done syntheses, kind of a literature that brings together all the clinical trials in the form of practice guidelines that give us summary recommendations or meta-analyses that give us summary findings of those recommendations, although there's a lot of other study material that's very important as well in the mix. And then it involves a skill set. The way I really think about evidence-based medicine is it involves a skill set to be able to transfer that evidence and solve an unknown. And that skill set, there are four skills required to effectively transfer evidence and solve what we don't know. And the first one is to know how to come up with the right clinical questions to begin with. The second piece is knowing how to go out and find the best available evidence. The third piece is knowing how to evaluate that evidence. And then finally, knowing how to apply it to the care of patients.
You mentioned, I don't want to get into, in this program, and particularly the details of how we know what we know and what's good good studies, but we often, on this program, and perhaps our listeners have heard the term randomized controlled trials before, and you mentioned that. What are we talking about, and why is this kind of a good line in the sand about trying to identify what's real and what's not real?
Yeah, that's a great question. And even in the landscape of evidence-based medicine, the perceived value of randomized controlled trials is starting to shift. So just going back to look at really the value of a randomized controlled trial, ultimately what trials do is we use trials to get to the truth. And so a randomized control trial takes a number of patients and subjects them to an intervention, and then randomly, and the key over here is randomly selects a control group that doesn't get the intervention. They may get placebo, or they may get another comparator agent. And then you look at what are the outcomes that happen in each group. And so this is considered to be the best scientific type of study. Now, the value of the randomized control trial is that it's very rigorous, especially when both groups are masked, meaning you don't know, both the patients and the researchers don't know who's getting what. And you've also made sure that the follow-up of patients in the trial is very, very good. The downside of, or not necessarily the downside, but the but randomized control trials only take us so far. The potential limitations is that when you do a randomized control trial, you really are studying a highly selected patient population. And so usually patients that have other illnesses or either are elderly or perhaps very young may not have been included in the trial. So ultimately what we try to do from randomized control trials is do the best we can to extrapolate the findings to real-world patients that we may more commonly see in the real world to make our best estimate. There are other study designs, which I won't get into the details of, but they're known as observational studies that can that are also helpful for us to make a best estimate on what interventions may look like in the real world.
Yeah, and just to maybe flesh this out a little bit more, I've always heard one of the problems with these randomized control trials is maybe people who get up or get into randomized control trials are going to be different from the population in that they may be more compliant about taking medications or following through with recommendations than everybody else in the real world. So we get a kind of not entirely accurate view of how a treatment, for example, might work.
Exactly. And so and that's why these other types of trials where you actually do a real-world study with a cold study where you're not intervening. The key of a randomized control trial, which is a type of experiment, is that you're actually doing something. You're giving an intervention. You're not giving an intervention and seeing what happens. A whole other realm of research is known as observational research, where you're simply watching in real-world populations what's happening without intervening. And in that way, you may find out that in a study where the compliance is 90 to 100% compliance, in the real world may be 40 or 50%, or where if you're evaluating surgeries, you may find in the study that you have a surgical complication rate of 3%, but when that's subjected to a real-world observation, you'll find in hospital settings across the country, the complication rate is more like 10%. And, of course, those differences could potentially sway how we might think of the benefit of a particular therapy.
Let me remind our listeners, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Daniel Friedland, and we're really talking about how to help patients who are listening think about and frame and find and evaluate information that might be of benefit to them on health care issues. And that's what Dr. Friedland does so well. And I want to mention there's a link to his website, Super Smart Health, on KSKA.org/line1 that you would get you to his website. But if you have questions during the program today, give us a call, 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. We do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And those of you who listen regularly know you can get us through the emails now at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at KSKA.org. Well, let's say we're thinking about a question or have an issue we'd like to investigate. Is there something we should do prior to beginning to get information? Is there a way we should think about this problem we're interested in knowing about?
Yeah, you know, and this gets into something I've been thinking a lot about over the last year, certainly since I had the pleasure of being on the air with you last, when the SuperSmart Health website was up. And at the time, SuperSmart Health was designed to be essentially a translation of evidence-based medicine for both healthcare providers and patients to really support a partnership to better health. And then I already started thinking, well, you know, what is smart health? And, you know, does smart health begin with that first step I mentioned earlier, which is coming up with the right clinical question to begin with? And what really troubled me was that the questions we tend to ask really come out of our vision of what we, how each of us see, define health. And so, for example, if and traditionally in the Western medical model, going through training, and this is shifting now, but in our paradigm, health has always been defined as the absence of disease. And if we go in with that as our personal vision of health, then the first types of questions we're going to ask is, how do we maintain absence of disease? On the other hand, if you use a broader definition of health, more along the lines of it being a dynamic state of one feeling fully alive, and that gets into a definition I've seen, for example, by the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine, then we begin to ask different types of questions. In addition, it's also very important for us to have a personal vision about how we approach our health. And one of the things that I've done on the new website, which will be up, I should mention, it will be up online hopefully within the next 4 weeks. And I know you have a link online, but when it's up, it starts with a vision of smart health. And the first principle in that vision is an acknowledgement of the importance of patient-centered care. So the first principle in that vision is really for patients to take ownership of their health. And so I lead in with principle one, which is the notion that each of us are the CEO of our health, if you will.
And so where does that take you then? So I'm trying to understand that as a listener. They are going to frame that question in maybe a different way than somebody else if they're looking for a specific question to answer. You're saying each of us may go at this a little differently?
Yeah, you know, so, you know, I think, you know, if you take the premise, and I should go through the four principles, if you start out with you being the CEO of your health, the second principle, which feeds into what I mentioned early on, is you define your vision for optimal health. So, for example, I had a call a few weeks ago about a patient. It was a family member whose patient had an advanced state of cancer, and had asked me about whether or not I thought certain modalities were important. And just reframing the question at that point was, before I got into saying, you know, does this work or does this potential intervention not work, and they were really wanting to explore the differences between chemotherapy and some of the other complementary alternative medicine modalities, it was very important to really construct a discussion on saying, well, what is, you know, what does health mean to the patient right now? And what, you know, what are their goals for health? Is their wish to be free of pain and suffering? Is the wish to really, you know, against all the challenges they're facing, to be really aggressive and going for a cure? And really understanding the landscape of that vision of health beforehand really helps us more narrowly target, you know, what's most important to the patient, and within that, what are the more important questions to have? And it turns out that the bulk of our discussion really centered around how the family could best support the patient around this time to be free of pain, and to really make sure that his spiritual wishes near the end of his life were taken care of, as well as his end-of-life planning.
So the as I understand, then the purpose is before we start asking questions, is we really want to focus as best we can on what is important to us and what is it specific we're looking for. And I guess we're doing that because there is so much information out there that it helps direct efficiently how we look for these answers.
Absolutely. And just really taking a big picture approach and saying, what is it that I really want to achieve right now in my health? And if I could do two or three things to support that, what, you know, might that be? So, and everybody has, may have a slightly different way of looking at their health.
You mentioned that you're redoing the website. You want to tell us about other directions you're moving and other things that might be of interest?
Well, one of the things, I really like to step back and take a big picture. And one of the things, I had been writing about evidence-based medicine for a long time. And while I feel that evidence-based medicine has immense value in really helping us discover scientific truth and really give us a external guidance on what might work, I also felt that something was missing. And one evening about 3 months ago, it really changed my direction because I was very interested in actually what is the root of the word health. And at about 3 o'clock one morning, I found myself looking up that dictionary definition on Webster's, and it turns out that health comes from the Old English hel, H. There's a squiggle on top of the A L, which is wholeness. And so, ultimately, patients do. Health is a is a goal in which we look to incorporate a sense of mind, body, and spirit to achieve essential wholeness. And also interesting to me is that the definition of the word patient comes from the Latin patior, which means suffering. So patients suffer from fragmentation in mind, body, and spirit, and our roles as healers, which also comes from that same derivation of the Old English wholeness, is to really bring our patients back to essential wholeness. So I felt like I was one third of the way there, where I really, if you take a systematic view of this, which was evidence-based medicine, I see that as the mind of health. So I provided three gateways. One is a gateway into the evidence-based medicine framework with many resources. But I've also then now wanted to flesh out two remaining gateways. And the next one is really looking at the body of health, and that really is for us to learn how to navigate the healthcare system. So everything there from finding a healthcare provider, finding facilities and finding support groups and services, and knowing how to organize the health information in personal health records and patient rights and end-of-life planning and care, and communicating with your healthcare provider, as an example, really wanted to put in there a structure and incorporate some of the best resources that I could find in that arena. So that really is really helping us find support for what works, which is really the body of health, if you will. And then the third gateway that I'm really excited by is really exploring the notion of really bringing spirituality into health. And so I have a gateway that's called Spirit-Guided Health, and really explore there, interestingly enough, using the same framework of evidence-based medicine, and I have to go into more detail, of frame, find, evaluate, and apply, but not using it looking for external guidance, but rather exploring how it can be used to internally guide us and draw on internal resources in which we can find meaning, motivation, and purpose to take action on what works. So these three gateways, really, the evidence-based medicine gateway helps one identify what works. The navigating the healthcare system is designed to really providing us support for what works. And the Spirit-Guided Health Resource Center really is designed to really explore how we might find meaning and motivation to take action on what works.
So you've really increased the potential content of this website tremendously, then.
Yeah, and in many ways it's been healing for me as well, because these have been diverse interests that I've had that I've really wanted to bring together for a long time. And I started, this, particularly the area of spirit-guided health, one of the most fulfilling things that I had done in medical school, which was, I'm sure, Dr. Woodard, you may remember that boot camp experience. It's a very challenging time as students coming through. And in my fourth year, I was privileged to found the Medical Student Network at the University of California, San Francisco, which was really designed to facilitate student well-being. And that it's always been has been an interest in mine to really continue that work in looking at both student and physician well-being, and really looking at the patient experience in terms of what is it that really brings a patient a foundational sense of well-being.
And that in particular would be found if people were to peruse this spiritual guidance portion of the website as it when it becomes available.
Yes, yes. And I do want to mention that, I really don't want to be so bold as to prescribe think that I have any insight such as that I to prescribe anybody's spirituality or certainly religion, and that's not my intent. The way I define spirit-guided health is really that it's ultimately the willingness to be inspired, whatever that means for you, to really draw on those internal resources that I believe that each of us has, that has inner wisdom and brings us to a place of compassion and wisdom to take better care of ourselves and others.
You know, and perhaps it's a time for me to point out, I suspect people always wonder, well, what's the catch? There's no charge for this information. This is something people can go to help them gather information and take care of themselves the best way they can.
Yeah, and I don't have a revenue model for this right now. It has been a labor of love, but I'm very happy to also be invited out and provide seminars and presentations for which I am reimbursed. But I really wanted this website to be free. My site's free, and by and large, most of the resources that I link to, it's been a lot of fun for me to be able to go out and cherry pick what I believe is some of the best resources out there, just to provide a gateway to many resources, many of which are government resources that are freely available. And so I really wanted to raise the profile of various website resources that really are truly, truly remarkable. That's been my privilege.
Remind our listeners again, this is Line 1, your health connection. We'll be on from 2 to 3 today, or just shortly before 3. If you've got questions about how to access information, how to frame information, how to think about getting information on the Internet, we're going to go through that a little bit more in detail in the next couple of minutes. But you're welcome to call and ask questions. 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. Our outside number, 1-888-353-5752, and email line1, lineone, at kska.org. And don't forget, if you find something you find interesting and want to share it, share that information with other individuals by going to kska.org/line1, and people can listen to this interview and podcast at any time for their convenience. Before I came on the program today, I was talking to my office administrator, Daniel, about what we were going to be talking about. And he said, you know, one of the questions we get periodically in the office is, what about how do we maximize our health insurance? How do we look at all the options that are out there for our families that fit us the best and so forth? And I said, you know, I don't know if that's going to be a component of what you're doing in that body of health section or not. And so if not, I thought I'd throw it out there. But any comments?
Yeah, I approached this that section that will be under the Navigating the Healthcare System section, and I have a health care insurance section and embedded resources. And really, you know, the first thing, you know, I think folks are really confused with the various types of insurance plans. You know, the difference between, for example, indemnity plans that cover the percentage of costs for care received and health maintenance, HMO plans, which we've all heard about, and, you know, that involves capitated care within or it involves an insurance premium for which, you know, all care is provided within that HMO, but then looking at the difference between PPOs and now consumer-directed coverage, which looks at high-deductible health plans where you can set aside, create health savings account, and certainly everybody's familiar with a government health plan. So just really looking at such as Medicare and Medicaid. So there really are a number of different kinds of plans. And then it's really what I then go into is really kind of trying to break this down into looking at providing consumer guides. For example, there's a fantastic section on there's a health insurance section in Medline Plus, and then there's also a resource from the America's Health Insurance Plans that and the National Association of Insurance Commissions that can get you started. And when you're blessed enough to have insurance, and you know the challenges, there's a way where you can go in, and I've provided a link to the National Committee for Quality Assurance, which then enables you to go in, type in your zip code, look for all the health plans, and create a health plan report card that will vet across the plans on domains such as looking at how, through your insurance, do they deal with preventative illness? How do they deal with post-discharge planning or taking care of illnesses and score that? So that's a really an extraordinary resource to help you to compare almost like a lot of there are resources to compare when you look for mortgages. There are many patients, unfortunately, that don't have health care insurance. You know, that number is over 40 million, and then there's another 25 million that are underinsured. So a large percentage of our population really may be asking questions, well, what if we don't have insurance or underinsured? And I've also provided links there to the Health Resources and Services Administration that really these are government-funded programs that can provide low-cost or no-cost care depending on your income. There's also what is underappreciated. There's there are a number of health centers that are called Hill-Burton free and reduced-cost care facilities, and I found this very interesting. And that is in 1946, the government provided funds for remodeling of a number of healthcare facilities around the countries, and in return, those facilities were obligated to provide free or low-cost care for patients who couldn't afford healthcare. And there are 200 of these facilities around the country. So, through this link that I provide, you can find if you have a Hill-Burton free reduced-cost care facility with you, and then certainly there are links to Medicare, Medicaid, and Medicare, and also a link to Insure Kids Now, which is a state child and insurance program, which provides coverage for younger patients to families in need. In addition, I've also provided a couple of resources that really help patients find resources if they have need, and one of those, a fantastic website is Patient Advocate Foundation. I believe it's patientadvocatefoundation.org, patientadvocate.org, and they help patients with chronic illnesses, cancer, and some of the inflammatory conditions as well deal with obtaining insurance or dealing with situations where they may be denied coverage or resolving debt crisis related to their diagnosis or negotiating access to pharmaceutical agents and coordinating the benefits and offer these services for free. And then finally, on the in the section, I also provide a link to Rx Assist, which is a resource that provides free drugs or low-cost drugs offered by pharmaceutical companies, and also there are, it also provides links to state programs for to medications for individuals that cannot afford them and are below certain income thresholds.
Okay. Let's see if we can maybe flesh out an example of how a specific illness question might be addressed. And I came up with the example of Parkinson's disease since last week we were talking with the neurologist, and there's certainly a lot going on in that area. So if you were a new patient that had a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, how might you direct them to educate themselves about this illness with the idea that they can discuss their options for treatment and understanding of this illness with their provider?
Yeah, you know, and what I love about this, first of all, is starting out, medicine is so vast, and obviously, even with all these links, there's just no ways I would be able to hold any, or any physician would be able to hold this information in their mind. So really, the idea of the website is to provide a gateway where you can say, well, who out there can I rely on who would be really reputable in directing me towards the best resources in this area. And one of my favorite websites, consumer-friendly websites that I really feel everybody should know about if they don't already, is Medline Plus. And Medline Plus is the consumer offering of the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. National Library of Medicine. On their site, it's not easily apparent from their site unless you really start digging around, but I have put a link to the site on the find section. There's an encyclopedic find section on the evidence-based medicine section, and I've also placed a link to this on the navigating the healthcare system underneath find support groups and services. So you can find this in Medline Plus in both locations, and specifically, there's a section that they have there called Other Resources. So it's not an easily apparent what that means. But what they've done is they've created a list of organizations grouped by health topic, and it's an A to Z list. And the nice thing about this is they've there's a group at the National Library of Medicine, and I've had the pleasure of meeting a number of individuals that work there. They do phenomenal work. And what they've done is they have gone out and scoured for the best resources out there using quality guidelines, where they've made sure that the these websites they're linked to need to meet authority, accuracy of health content. And they also want to make sure that the primary purpose of the web page is educational and not to sell a product or service. And so if I go over here, and I'm clicking through right now online, if I go under P, so I'm going to find along with you, it starts out with pacemakers and implantable defibrillators and goes through in alphabetical order. And as I go down here to Parkinson's disease, they have five resources that they offer. There's the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. There's the National Institute of Neurologic Disorders and Stroke, the National Parkinson's Foundation, the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, and an organization called WeMove. So rather than going to a general search engine like Google, where I could search, and actually Medline Plus, I will say, does come up pretty high on any Google search. But rather than going to that where I may be overwhelmed with a number of commercial resources, going through Medline Plus gives us access to vetted, pre-screened, top-flight resources, just five to start off with rather than getting overwhelmed.
We also have a link on our website, line one at kska.org, the link to Medline Plus, because I've referred to it a number of times, and it's a wonderful site. How do people, can they trust the site? So, should we talk about how people might look at the information they're getting and try to evaluate the reliability?
Yeah, that's a great question. And before mention that the link that you have on your site right now, it's Super Smart Health. There's an old version of the website up, which is Straight Evidence-Based Medicine. And
okay.
Just to remind that in 4 weeks' time, that link will be the new updated one with the other two gateways I've mentioned. The issue of evaluating, going back to the framework of evidence-based medicine, which started out with asking the right question and then finding the best information, then the third piece of that was evaluating the information before we apply it. So that's a very big part of evidence-based medicine. On my new website, I've broken that down into two main areas. The first area is to really evaluate the reliability of the website itself. And then the second part is hopefully that website will reference articles that support a recommendation or a finding. So the second piece then becomes knowing how to evaluate the reliability of research referenced on the website. So it's really designed to be very thorough. Obviously, patients will decide how deep they want to drill on this, certainly if it's an article that is a life and death decision. One might really want to take a deep dive on it. But giving a top flight overview of this, when I consider issues of reliability of website, I really think about three main areas to consider. The first one is the authority of the website. So I want to know who runs it, and you can find this oftentimes in the About Us link. And I want to know, are they qualified to address our needs? I want to know, do they have qualifications in the area that you're interested in? When I look at the website, I want to know whose perspective are they representing? Is this a patient advocacy organization? Is this a specialty group? Is this a patient organization? And then I also want to know, do these individuals have any conflicts of interest? So I'm really looking at the outset for authority. Then the next thing I'm looking at is accuracy. I want to know who actually writes the content. Are these professional writers, or are they material reviewed by qualified healthcare professionals? And is the information based on expert opinion or a balanced review of the published research? And do I have links that I can get into that research to judge the underlying database? And then finally, I want to know, for accuracy, I want to know, well, do any of these individuals have conflicts of interest that could easily bias or sway how they might position and balance that information? So, looking really at what commercial interests may be driving that. So those are the first two areas, looking at authority and accuracy. And then the final area I look at is currency. I want to know if the website, when it was last reviewed and whether the information is up to date.
Are there organizations that are trying to do that for the patients? I'm thinking of the HON code, the Health on the Net code. Is that worth talking about that?
Yeah. HON code, they offer a great service. And what they've come up with is they're a group out of Geneva. They've been around since near the beginning of the ramp-up of the Internet, looking at the healthcare landscape. And really, they've put forth eight principles that deserve an on-code seal. So these are seals of approval. It's very difficult for any group to really vet the accuracy of a website. So a number of these seals, such as OnCode, and then there's another one put out by URAC, URAC. Rather than looking at accuracy, they look at issues more along the lines of transparency of the website. So covering some of the issues that I look for myself in the website. So there, they look to see whether or not the website's authoritative. They look at issues. They want to make sure that the information is complementary, so it supports and doesn't replace the doctor-patient relationship, which I think is very important too. They look at issues of privacy, and they want to make sure that everything's well attributed. So they look at whether or not the information was cited, and other issues of transparency, if everything is just to make sure that you can link to everything and find out where it came from, and financial disclosure, and looking, making sure that they have a clear advertising policy, so that that we don't get confused looking at balanced evidence versus marketing on any given website. So these are all important issues that I think are well worth knowing about.
Another issue that comes to my mind when I'm trying to think about talking with patients, interacting with patients on a daily basis, is a situation where I may have a patient that's asking me to prescribe a treatment that maybe I don't believe is effective or safe, and you may want to address the safety efficacy of treatments as well. But how would you counsel me? How would you suggest professionals deal with patients who are asking for treatments the provider may not have confidence in for one reason or the other?
Yeah, and so this goes back to right at the beginning of the new revision, I go through those four principles of smart health, which again comes back to that principle, you are the CEO of your health and you define your vision for optimal health, and patients recognize resources to support their vision and they're empowered to implement resources. So looking at that first principle, when a patient comes in, I recognize as a physician that I'm there in service of my patient. And so I know that patients really are going to basically be driving decisions. The caveat over here, which is tricky, is that if I as a physician know that something is going to be harmful or not effective for the patient, this would be akin to a CEO who says, look, I could employ yes men or I could employ people that will tell me the truth to make sure that this corporation stays healthy. So I think in that situation, and certainly with the oath we've taken to do no harm, in good conscience, I don't believe that any physician's obligated to provide a patient a medication that is potentially harmful and not very effective. But I think to really engage in a shared decision-making discussion, which is most often, what patients are trying to establish, is to provide a framework for that discussion. And one of the things that I think is really a helpful framework is whenever I'm weighing up between two alternative strategies, I use a mnemonic, step C, which is I'm looking at can the evidence show me or other information show me that this one agent is one step C better than another agent? And so the issues that I help really structure the discussion around with patients is looking really at the issues very clearly in terms of safety, tolerability, efficacy, price, and convenience. And usually the two areas that are very important to start with already are safety and efficacy. And I think when clearly we're faced with a situation where there's good evidence, grade A, well-done trials that show safety concerns and don't show any benefit, then I think it becomes clear. I think the more common challenge we face is where indeed the evidence is weak to clarify the relative benefits, safety, and harm of a given product. And that's when I feel in that situation, you're really engaging in a productive discussion with our patients where as long as best I can share with them, they understand the risks and benefits of the therapy. As the CEO of their health, the patient, gets to make that decision.
Let me give our phone number again. It's line one. We're talking about making good decisions and how to go about doing that, particularly on the internet. We've been talking with Dr. Daniel Friedland, who has a website that is designed to help consumers or patients in particular do that, called Super Smart Health. If you've got questions about anything you've heard today, give us a call, 550-8433. You can also reach us at line one, LINEONE, at KSKA.org. And remember, if you're listening after 3 o'clock, between 7 and 8 when we rebroadcast, there's no call-ins at that time. However, you certainly can listen to the program at any time by going to KSK.org. You've mentioned Medline Plus as a excellent starting place for a lot of these questions. Are there a couple of other websites that we should be aware of that you go to a lot or have a lot of confidence in?
I know I've been giving long answers over here, so I'll really try to, keep my enthusiasm, circumscribed. When I approach the framework of finding information, I really look to provide upfront a place where I can, let's say that patients and physicians are not familiar with a topic area. So we're not foundational in our knowledge. So the first place I go, I really try to marry a need for efficiency. And then when I have time, it's important I want to drill down to the envelope of knowledge and be very rigorous. So when I'm starting out being very efficient, I start out with online textbooks. And there are a number of online textbooks that physicians use that it would be helpful for patients to know about. And I know it may be asking a lot of some patients to really read some of the textbooks, but a number of these textbooks have patient resources that are very good. And a couple of texts come to mind. One is UpToDate, which is widely used by medical schools and residency programs and physician offices around the country. And they have very nice resources. If somebody's very motivated to actually want to pay to use the textbook for a week and read the chapter their doctor's actually read before they walk in the room, they have the option of doing that. The other one is eMedicine, which is a resource now owned by WebMD that with registration is freely available, and they've got links into consumer resources as well. So both of these get you into pretty solid information off the bat, giving foundational knowledge. In addition, for patients, there, in addition to Medline Plus, there are a number of very good resources, a number of other government resources, such as NIH Health Information, which is put out by the National Institutes of Health, clearing information from all their centers, and that's health.nih.gov. There's also Health Finder, which is the consumer resource offered by the Department of Health and Human Services. A couple of resources from well-known academic institutions bear mentioning. Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic are solid resources. A resource from one of the best resources from a professional organization, which is their resource from the Academy, American Academy of Family Practice, is familydoctor.org. And then certainly the very well-known consumer resources, WebMD and Revolution Health, are also worth taking a look at. And initially when I started the website, I had been more inclined to say, look at the government resources first. But I will say that with the amount of funding resources like WebMD and Revolution have, they've really been able to affiliate themselves with other highly credible resources to really make sure that they clear solid information. So, for example, WebMD has a an agreement with Cleveland Clinic and will clear a number of their resources. Revolution Health will clear Cleveland Clinic and Mayo Clinic's resources as well. So they are worth taking a closer look at. And there are also a number of resources, if you're interested, we could go into on looking at complementary alternative medicine. But
Yeah, perhaps a recommendation on that source, that topic would be a good one. Next week we're going to be looking at alternative medicine a little bit, so it would be nice to have a source that you'd recommend about that.
Certainly. The two resources that really are the evidence-based medicine authorities on this unfortunately require a subscription. And those are the Natural Medicine's Comprehensive Database and the Natural Standard Database. The one nice thing is that from a patient level, if you go into Medline Plus and you click on the drugs and supplements section,
right,
you will find a free access to the consumer version of the Natural Standard Database, which really provides ratings on the use of various natural supplements for various conditions, from grade A evidencing, there's a lot of evidence to support that this works for that condition, all the way down to F, which is strong evidence against the use. In addition, there's also the NIH has sponsored the National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine, known as NCAM. Well worth taking a look over there. And there's also a good section in Medline Plus on complementary alternative medicine. So that would be a good place to start as well.
Okay. We just have about 7 minutes or so, and I'd like to give my guests an opportunity to move in a direction they may want to move in. I'm interested in asking you about national guidelines and so forth, but are there a topic or two that you want to make sure we address that we have not at this point?
Yeah, just to give us an appropriate balance, we're living in uncertain times right now. Today certainly there are a lot of folks today really feeling very uncertain about our economy and with that, there's a lot of stress that comes with that. And so what I'm very passionate about is this the section of the website, which it's Spirit Guided Health, but it really is the portal that really deals with how do we go about navigating stress and uncertainty in our lives, and really looking at the relationship between stress and health. And what I found really very interesting as I was putting this website together, I came across an article that stated that between 75 and 90% of all health conditions that patients present to their primary care healthcare providers with, 75 to 90% of those conditions are either directly or indirectly related to stress. And then I started thinking more about this, and what I realized, the patients come into the doctor's room with their stress-related conditions, and the moment they step in, they very quickly realize that they're only the second most stressed-out person in the room because physicians are, in general, are under immense pressures with the need to see more and more patients, with this overwhelming amount of information that they've got to keep abreast of, falling reimbursements. And so in the short time of a clinic visit, oftentimes conditions are more rapidly medicated than fully explored, because it's very difficult for us to find the time to really go into, and uncover, what is it that's really kind of at the stress that's at the bottom of some of or related to some of these healthcare conditions. So I was very interested in wanting to explore that. And as I mentioned earlier, I've used the frame, find, evaluate, and apply piece to deal with that. So the first part in looking at stress is to notice when it arises, and also notice how it fragments us. And typically, when we feel stress, we find ourselves engaging in instinctively. We fight and take flight, and so if we're feeling stress and that's raising a lot of self-doubt, we may find ourselves unwittingly or without even knowing we're doing it, fighting to prove self-worth or taking flight from things that trigger self-doubt. And while that can be very, very adaptive, at times our defenses can also do more harm than good. And certainly the stress can actually have an impact on our body as well. So I think there's great benefit in terms of noticing when we're going into these fight-and-flight behaviors and being able to do an audit about are we doing more harm than good? And then having the insight and courage to make the turn. And at that point when we make the turn, really turning towards things that bring us fulfillment and really reflecting on what brings us fulfillment, which is, you know, learning and exploration and the meaning we find in connection and our ability to express ourselves at the limit of our ability and be of service to others. And so what I found is that the frame, find, evaluate, and apply framework is very helpful to structuring and drawing on inspiration to make that turn into fulfillment. And so, for example, the framing the question piece, like evidence-based medicine, begins with a well-framed clinical question, which really takes us into scientific research. Here, on this gateway in spirit-guided health, instead of when we're feeling very stressed out, where thought processes might be, what's wrong with me, why do I always mess up, you know, why did I do this, which rarely brings inspiring answers, to ask better questions such as, what is it that I need to learn in this moment? How can I better heal with this person? What is it that I need to say to this person? How can I better express myself? Or what's causing my fear that may be blocking me? And then from there, once we've seeded those questions, to moving to the find section. And in the find section, rather than finding an answer on a computer database, that piece is really learning how to create stillness in our lives so the answers can find us. And whether one believes these answers come from intuition or from God or whatever your worldview is, I do believe we have this inner wisdom that we can draw on, whether it be through walking in nature, through engaging in vigorous activity, through prayer, through meditation, through yoga. There are ways we can create stillness to invite answers. And then when the answers come, you know, we have the wisdom to trust our knowing of what feels right, more than what feels good. And really the litmus test is, do the answers, are they good for us and others? And do they bring me to a place where I'm more free to receive and give love? And then the final piece that I explore in this is the apply piece, which is the courage and inspiration to take action on what is good for us and others. And then to close the loop on the frame piece, which is after taking action, to reflect on, are we and others vitalized by our actions? And if not, we ask more questions. And if we are, you know, that really, for me, invites a lot of wonder and appreciation for this mysterious, you know, source of inspiration that empowers our health and well-being. So, yeah. You know, that's a section that I really hope people will find very useful and will, you know, and will stand as the missing link between fusing the important need for science, the science of what works, and also drawing on spiritual inspiration, if you will, to really provide us a sense of wholeness, which gets back to this notion or the root of the word health.
I really have to applaud your abilities and your desires and your information. I can't strongly recommend Super Smart Health, especially in its new format, which will come out in about a month. So, Daniel, thanks extremely from me. It's been a wonderful another short period of time talking with you.
Thank you, Dr. Wood, and it's been an absolute privilege and a delight speaking with you again, and I look forward to the time we next meet up there in Alaska.
All right, Daniel. Have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Next week we'll be returning, and we're going to talk to about a book, Trick or Treatment, alternative medicine on trial, with one of the authors, Simon Singh. So tune into your health and learn more Monday, October 6th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1.
Your Health Connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.